In today's episode, I talk with Richard Nielsen, who is the founder of MyPetGo. They raised a lot of money. They want to build a longevity program for animals, which means that your dog will live longer. They do this via an app, but also via a hardware device, which your dog wears. And in this podcast episode, we also talk about the life of Richard, starting in Sweden, moving to Hong Kong, doing some digital publishing, selling this company, and now living in Barcelona and doing this MyPetGo company. So let's go. Okay, welcome to a new episode of the Digital Economics Podcast. Today, I speak with Richard Nielsen, who has been living in Sweden, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, many countries, and now is living in Barcelona, building MyPetGo. We will talk about MyPetGo later. First of all, I want to say thank you for being on the podcast, and I would like to go a little bit through your life, because you're a board member of many companies, you're an investor, and now you build your own company, and I would like you know more about your life, how this went, that you were traveling so much and doing so many company things. And where do we start? Where is a good place to start that story?
Yeah, well, first off, thank you for having me. I guess a good starting point would be, you know, as a young man, I was quite exposed to entrepreneurship through my lovely parents. So my father was still is working in the boat industry, and he's done everything you could do in the boat industry. We're at our own brands that we've created and built them. We built them back in the olden days in Sarasota in Florida. So spent a lot of time in the U.S. as a child, and U.S. to me was always paradise, in particular Florida. And you know, we spent a lot of time in Sarasota, Fort Lauderdale, Naples, different areas, right? Not so much Miami, but you know, we were there too, Key West all the way down, right? And so he built boats. He had a brokerage where we sold secondhand boats, right? Or rather yachts. For Northern Europe, we also represented a lot of big boating brands, both American and other European. In particular, the largest French manufacturers, Beneteau and Chanot. And so I helped him out a lot with whatever he needed help with, right? Polishing the boats, cleaning the boats, helping with exhibitions, whether they were floating or indoors. Essentially learning the craft of sales at an early age, right? Because, you know, he had all these various floating vehicles that needed to be sold. And so, you know, he kind of put me on a boat out of 15 boats at a floating exhibition as a 10-year-old, you know, and sort of by myself and just like, sell it. And so, of course, I had watched him, how he would talk and how he would kind of lift out the unique selling points of the boats, because at these exhibitions, you would have essentially your entire competition there, you know, selling their unique selling point and why one should buy that boat. So I guess I saw that early on, and I liked sales. So that came very naturally to me, you know, and I also liked the art of a deal and business broadly. And so I did that. My mother was in the mice industry and still is in the mice industry, where she did a lot of corporate events. She sold this to big companies. And she did at sometimes work for corporate. So American Express had this sort of mice arm, and she kind of headed that up for a while, but then went solo, and she's solo today, doing that for you know, a couple of big property developers in Sweden and whatnot. And they want to these big mice things and board meetings at exotic places. So she does a lot of that. And so, you know, one could say that I got some entrepreneurial blood or you know, it's part of my genes. And I thought very often that I would be destined to kind of build my own thing, start my own thing. And I guess that's what I did. Eventually, I mean, I did smaller things from, you know, cutting the neighbor's flowers in their garden and trying to resell it back to them, right? And because you're cute, the old lady would give you, you know, 5 kroners, Swedish kroners, which was like, you know, 50 cent euro, right, today. translated, right? Give or take. And so, you know, and you could call that entrepreneurship, but maybe it's not really, but it was, you know, it was, you know, trying to earn my own money was something that was quite important. Tennis played a very huge role in my life as I aspired to be a tennis pro. And unfortunately, I wasn't good enough. I usually say it was my knee that gave in, or gave up, I should say, but it was probably the fact that I wasn't as good as I needed to be. However, my younger twin brothers, they were the best in all of Europe, at, you know, during the youth years, and played both at Bolitieri Sports Academy in Bradenton in Florida, but also played at the subsequent one that they opened in outside of Berlin, in Germany, and, you know, had some of the best trainers in Sweden, the old trainer of Thomas Enquist and so on and so forth, which was my trainer at one point as well. But, you know, I wasn't nearly as successful. Now, they would probably never have been as successful as they were unless they had an older brother who played tennis, which got them interested and got them interested at a very young age. So I guess the takeaway from the sports to the entrepreneurial world is that kind of never give up spirit, and you know, there is a lot of attributes on the sport that one can kind of take into the world of business. You know, one of those is practice makes perfect, right? So the more you practice, the better you will get. If you listen to your coach, you will get better, right? And I think in the world of business, it's kind of like, listen to your customers. They're always right, though maybe sometimes they're not. But there is a lot of takeaways, right? Listen to your peers, listen to your mentors, listen to your whoever it may be in business that can give you good advice that you can put into practice, and so on and so forth. So tennis was an important one. And then, you know, I did all sorts of things at a young age, from simplistic work to, you know, sort of, I studied entrepreneurship when that was a fresh new topic that one could study at a Swedish School of Entrepreneurship. So part of that was setting up our own company at, you know, during the time. And so I did that, and I liked it. And
you know, what did you build? What was the first company you built?
Well, it was a events business where we were running, I mean, you could say event marketing / nightclub events, which was ticketed. So you made money on selling tickets, but you then incorporate a lot of sponsors, right, into the event that wanted to get the exposure to this, let's say, this rather trendy audience that would show up at these events. And I did that at some of the leading nightclubs and you know, around Stockholm and also in other areas. And you know, this is sort of before tech became tech, and before technology was the big thing that it is today. And eventually I ended up in Hong Kong, and that's where I started, I guess, what I'd like to call my first real business. I was about 20, 21 at the time. And we'd seen these, and it was somewhat related to what I did, right, with events and you know, being at the nightclubs and whatnot, in that in Stockholm at the time, or in Sweden at the time, we had three digital magazines. This is, again, this is like 04, 05. So really, post.com crash. And we had these three magazines that were, on the one hand, taking pictures of the people that went to these events and parties. And it was regular people, and some were kind of half famous and some were famous, right? But the point was that the regular Joe could be in one of those images. And it was sort of glorified. But it was also a magazine where they wrote articles and the idea was to try to be the early, you know, the first with the latest news, as opposed to what you read in glossy print, which is very old news when you get that in your hand, right? Because of the publishing cycle. So we you know, me and two friends, we kind of liked that. We saw these three magazines were doing well. They had communities built in so people could kind of meet and talk and share images and share, you know, talk about passion topics in their life. And we sort of asked ourselves, could this be done somewhere else in the world? And Hong Kong was kind of like, okay, let's do it in Hong Kong because that's the New York of Asia or the London of Asia. And, you know, we went down on a research trip and came back 2 weeks later and sort of fell in love with Hong Kong and sort of said, what a cool place. And I guess 4 months later, we moved there, right? We gave up our jobs, moved there and started this thing that became Lifestyle Asia, but the initial working name was Lifestyle Hong Kong because it was only in Hong Kong. So that gives you sort of a snapshot of what of that. There's a lot of other things in between, but I guess we will come to it.
And Lifestyle Asia is still existing, right? Like I looked it up. It's a website where you see news and stuff. Weekly horoscope for Taurus. Best movies to watch maybe in Hong Kong.
I don't know if we do the horoscope. We never did when I was there, but maybe if you go to the Thai version, you'll see it. It's lifestyleasia.com as a URL. Just making sure you're on the right one. There is something different in the Philippines with the same name but different URL. And so yeah, it's still around. I think the business is doing quite well. I think that business we started in Hong Kong, we expanded to Singapore in 2008. We then expanded to, Thailand in 2009, Malaysia in 2012. We then sold that to Hubert Berta Media, which is a German media and tech conglomerate, in 2016. And then it was, I stayed on for many years there. And helped them with digital transformation broadly and headed up all the digital assets and helped to improve and do knowledge transfer and the list went on and on. So that was quite fun. But at one point it was like, media is getting very challenging with the platform players, the Meta token and
how did you monetize? How did you earn money?
It was fully advertisement driven, right? And it still is. I think when we started that, we were sort of the pioneer in digital lifestyle and luxury publishing, across Asia. So and what one needs to understand is if you're in Berlin or in Munich or, there's one Louis Vuitton store. If you're in Hong Kong, there's 10 of them, right? So there's a different concentration. If you're in Singapore, it's maybe 5 or 6, right? And so there is multiple stores within the same capital city, right? Or within the same large city. And Hong Kong and Singapore are unique because they're city states. They're not countries, right? But, there is a very large consumption and people tend to wear this almost as their daily clothes. And it's very, fashionable places. Obviously there's a lot of tourism that drives that too, because they're fun places. There is a lot to see. There's a lot to eat. There is a lot to drink. There is a lot to shop and the list goes on. And part of that, we communicated very well through Lifestyle Asia where we talked, we had a city guide, an event guide. It's kind of like where to go in the city. Then the event guide kind of what to do in the city. And then the magazine where we talked about everything from luxury watches to jewelry to fashion to art to philanthropy to, cars, yachts, property, and the list goes on and on. After we sold it, it gradually became broader and a bit more mass market. When we had it, our top advertisers were LVMH as a group, Caring as a group, the independents like Rolex and Patek but also the likes of Richemont that has Cartier and a lot of other brands Swatch Group that owns Omega and all that. So a lot of watches. Richard Mille was a big advertiser. Van Cleef & Arpels, I think, was the very early advertiser with us. In 2008, they started with digital publishing, with digital advertising, which was way ahead of a lot of the other jewelry brands. But we did all these crazy pop-up banners, all these wraparounds, and we were the ones who came up with that, and then the market kind of followed us. We were really pioneers in pushing that. We called it intro banners, and we had different names for it. And quite often the ad agencies couldn't track these campaigns because they didn't have the tools for it, because they were so bespoke or so different. But we had the highest CPM, or cost per mil, which is how you chart for banner advertising, in all of Asia, right? Much higher than Financial Times.
What did you charge?
I can't remember at the, what it was at the peak, but it was hundreds of US dollars per CPM.
Oh, shit. Okay, crazy. Crazy.
And so, yeah, I mean, we had the intro banner. I think we charged 1,000 US dollars per CPM or something, which these brands would pay, but they wanted, they're the only one who has that particular banner, right? So nobody else. And exclusivity, if you think of it, like if that is the back page of your Vogue magazine and you buy that as an advertiser, that's the equivalent, right? But it's kind of like the front cover. But that's how the luxury brands were. So we were trying to kind of mimic that of the glossy print to what we could, but then doing it online with the unique selling point of being first with the latest news. You know, what you're reading is yesterday's news, but you read it tomorrow. So that doesn't make any sense, right? And today, nobody kind of, I mean, now print has had a little bit of a revival because some people kind of like the art form and, but I think at the time it was like this mass influx of readers that went online. And obviously, when we started pre the first iPhone, but I think a lot of that changed when the first iPhone came out. And then, so we started being a desktop only offering, and then the smartphones came, and of course you had to adjust and have different solutions there. We also did offline marketing. This is when we did events. And that's why I said there was certainly a connection to my old life a bit. So we did in-store events, we did bespoke events, we did all sorts of things where so there was a digital world to what we did, but then there was this sort of physical world as well. So it was marketing in different shapes and forms. That's how we monetized. Eventually, the idea was everything you read about, you should be able to buy with a click of a button, right? And that's when you wanted to go completely transactional. I think they abandoned that. Again, I left the business in 2000 and 2020. So it's been a while, or maybe 2019, end of 2019. So it's been a while, but it's still there. It's doing okay. I mean, I still know some people there. So it has good traffic, but again, I don't know to what degree so this group that bought it, they had a lot of other luxury magazines. And I think at some point they realized that some of them were cannibalizing each other because they were so close. And I think that's when they decided to go broader with Lifestyle Asia, because it was kind of affecting another brand called Prestige that they had. Though Prestige was targeting the upper echelon, or the what we call the creme de la creme, or the sort of, I wouldn't say upper class, but you kind of call it the socialites, which is not the same thing as the social elite, but certainly the people that, they live a very glamorous lifestyle, right? They're sipping champagne daily. They live in the shopping mall, and they buy all this stuff. And that tends to be very driven by the housewives, right? So, yeah.
That's such a crazy world. I myself feel more like a low-budget backpacker sometimes, even if I'm not anymore. But I really like this kind of people, and I really like hiking and that kind of stuff. And that luxury world is really far away from me. But I think it's crazy the CPM you told me. Like I looked it up. It's 13 to 15 euros for the CPM on YouTube between Q4 2020 and Q4 2023. So like that's a huge like distance between these numbers. But how were like the I guess you can call it click through rates, like how many people were actually clicking on the banners? Because that's maybe also different, that really people were clicking on it, right?
I mean, look, I think on the intro banners, you know, we would have we would have like a CTR rate of 40% at times, right? And so, and it was super high, right? But you know, we have a term in the media industry called fat fingers, especially on mobile, and that is that, you know, you can't click it away, and you accidentally click in on the banner. You're trying to click the cross where you kind of you don't want to see it, but you know, and those buttons were really bad in the beginning, and then they got better. And again, you know, when we launched a lot of these various innovative banners, there was really no good way to track them, and therefore there was no proper framework, right, to follow. And so we built bespoke solutions for a lot of these luxury guys. And look, they don't care so much about, at that time, they didn't care so much about CTR and all this other stuff. And certainly you couldn't buy their stuff online anyways, right? Today you can buy all this luxury stuff. So you know, they want to look at the funnel. They want to know, you know, drill down pages and how long time there's been. That wasn't at all of interest. It was more, you know, we know that the audience is more and more online, so we need to be present. There was very few options available that was brand safe, that had this type of content and this type of audience. And therefore, it felt like a brand safe environment, right? And it took these guys a long time to embrace social media, because at social media, they couldn't control where their ads were seen next to what type of image. It could be a half person. It could have been something politically, you know, that they didn't like, that wasn't on brand, you know, as they would say. So it came with a lot of these negativities, right? Or it could have been, you know, gory stuff, bloody stuff, whatnot. And so we were seen as that default platform to go to. Of course, competition kind of creeped up, and you know, social eventually, you know, took a huge amount of the budget pie as it got more excessive.
You mean with social, like Instagram and stuff?
Yes.
Or
yes, well, Instagram was the one who was eating the world in the year of 2018, 19, 20. They were on steroids. All of a sudden Cartier and Rolex and everybody kind of embraced it. And you know, it's a bit of when enough brands go there, the other guys, they play follow John. So they just have to go as well. But you know, they own the data. They can play with the supply and demand. They don't produce any content. There are content curators that are giving the content away for free. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good business model. What can you say?
Very good, then.
With Lifestyle Asia, so you didn't have investors when you started everything, but you started all of that from scratch, right?
Yeah, that's right. We raised money year two for that. So we moved to Hong Kong, packed our bags, and which was like a luggage bag with, you know, the most necessary stuff, right? And we moved to Hong Kong and we stayed in this apartment together and we worked there and we lived on top of each other and the other guys couldn't cook. So I had to cook for everybody. Not that I was, you know, an incredible cook at the time, but I knew how to boil pasta and
the know, least worst.
I'm supposed to get. But you know, it was sort of magical because, you know, we kind of elbowed ourselves into the Hong Kong market and we then got invited to all the big events and always there. We were always the, like the young Swedes that like all these events. And we got to know a lot of the older guys that were working in banking and in the fashion industry and whatnot. And we kind of got embraced there and that helped a lot. But yeah, so we raised, you know, 1 million Swedish, which is 100K US dollars, and with that we could kind of do quite good things. And you know, throughout the Lifestyle Asia journey, we only raised $1 million US dollars in total. I think maybe it was somewhat more. Maybe it was 1.2, but 1.1, but it was very little in the context. You know, that was over a 10-year period. So we organically expanded into new markets. We had to be very careful with cash flow. We had to be, you know, but you know, when we sold it, we had a 35% profit margin, I think. And you know, in I think in Malaysia, as we sold it, we had 55% profit margin. It was an amazing market. But you know, we were like across the countries, we were 25 people. So we had a central unit that ran the tech, and then we had like writers in each of the markets, and we had sales in each of the markets. And we had like a regional management team, which was me and the co-founders. And you know, we tried to run it as lean as we could. And be smart about it, right? And I think the problem that Print had, Glossy Print, was they were so stuck in the old world of hierarchy. They must have a publisher, and under the publisher is a managing editor, and under that there's a sub editor, and then there is that is always. So we did nothing of that. Like we just had writers, and then we had like one managing editor across the region who managed all the writers, and it was all about producing as much high quality content as you could to build eyeballs, to be able to sell the CPM model, and then sort of go more offline and find other ways. But yeah, I mean, that was what we did.
And you and your friends, or you and your co-founders, no. Was it like a friends group? Or I talked about friends, but I assume it feels like a little bit you were friends from college, who went to university together, who made parties, then moved together to Hong Kong for a research trip, which was probably also some party, and then you were co-founders? Or am I totally wrong? Were you like really serious business partners?
Well, I mean, we didn't go to uni together, but we all had, let's say, a foot in the party scene a little bit, Stockholm. And we, of course, like to go and party together. And I think, you know, we saw this opportunity where we knew a guy in Hong Kong who said, you know, you should totally come here and set something up, because, you know, he was a foreigner. There was a big expat community that couldn't read Cantonese, which is the local language there. And he said, you know, I don't know where to go and spend my money. I don't know where to go and hang out. I don't know, you know, where to go and eat. And we have to remember, this is in 05, right? 06. So, you know, we've come a long way, right? And it's not that long ago, but it's like, you know, people were still sending faxes back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
They hardly use
they email. Still do in Germany. You yeah, wouldn't
yeah,
believe.
Yeah. Yeah, they do here in Spain too, right? They're like, hey, you got a fax number? I'm like, no, I don't. I'm sorry. That works. But so, you know, yes and no, we weren't going to uni together, but yes, we were friends and we saw this opportunity as a collective. And the problem was we were three salespeople. Like we didn't have the technical capabilities of building a magazine, or, you know, we had no experience coding. And so we were in many ways not the optimal team from that standpoint. You probably want to have like someone who's good at marketing, someone who's good who's an all-rounder at the tech side, who can build code and deal with whatever it is. And then you want to have someone who's a strong salesperson. Like we were three salespeople, so we were always good at monetizing, but we were not so good at all the other stuff. And some people might say, you know, that's the most important thing. And it's like, yeah, yes and no, right? But I think, we then had to do, we had to bring in a CTO as a retroactive co-founder, you know, that sort of worked out, but
I think that that's a really interesting thing you mentioned, like is it a problem, or is it like of course best case if that you have a tech guy, that you have a sales guy, maybe someone also for marketing, but I think tech and sales is kind of connected with each other. And is it like better to be like a tech guy without sales knowledge, or is it better to have sales knowledge but missing the technical stuff? And I recognize that I know some people who just have the sales side and do pretty well. And I mean, obviously, you guys did a good job and it was working out. And I know like some influencers who, for example, sell like courses where they don't really have anything, but they build a cohort and whatever, and they are just really good in selling. And I know a lot of like techies who build like cool stuff, but no one ever sees it. And I think that's like a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, look,
good in selling.
Yeah, I think you can hire anything these days, right? Being able to monetize is obviously a gift, right? And a very important one, right? Like you said, there is a lot of tech that never see the daylight because, you know, it wasn't properly monetized and they ran out of money and they gave up on it, right? And so so there's a lot of truth in that. But I think if you can't build any IP, you have nothing to sell. So just having a couple of salespeople saying, you know, this new AI thing would be awesome. We could sell it to this and this and this. I would have so many clients who would want to buy it. Yeah, but okay. So who's going to build that AI thing that's going to be huge and that you're going to be able to monetize? So you're going to need, in today's world, you're going to need some very good people on the tech side to be able to help you build that IP that you're going to sell. And that intellectual property, you know, can look in different shapes and forms. And you can certainly hire, you know, with the ability of outsourcing things to Vietnam or India or Ukraine or wherever it is, right? You can do that, and a lot of people do that, and that's fine. Or you can find people on Upwork or similar sites where, you know, someone comes in and helps you with a marketing plan, or, you know, so there's all of that stuff. But usually what you have is two camps when you talk about tech, and it's like you got the business minded entrepreneur or you have the technology entrepreneur. And they're usually very different. So the technology entrepreneur tends to be really bad at the business side and the other way around, right? And the business guy is really bad at the tech. And so they kind of need each other. So I think if you think of a duo as a complementing startup team or two co-founders, you want to have that tech guy that is quite broad in what he or she can do. And then you want to have the business guy that needs to be quite broad in what he or she does in terms of the business side. And that's everything from, you know, accounting to how handling books to how to put together some rules and regulations for the company, because you're going to need that, right? Sooner or later, to how do you sell it? How do you monetize it? What CRM tool should be used? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So I think you can find people that are good at sales and marketing. And then you need to find that other person that's good at the tech, right? And tech is so broad today. Are you an AI engineer? Are you a front end? Are you a back end? Are you a full stack? Like what is it that you are? And you know, it's hard to be an expert in every area. But it's good to have a generalist to start with, because that person tends to add things a little bit, and they tend to always have a network, and they go and kind of ask around, how do I do this? How do I do that? And you know, but as you grow, you're going to need like specialists, right? They're really good at Android, really good at iOS, really good at, you know, really good at maybe machine learning models and, you know, building algorithms, whatever it may pertain to. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a really interesting topic. I've thought about that a lot, because I see in many, many teams, like these two founders, like the tech founder, the sales marketing, like going out, knocking on doors founder. And I also like, I really like building projects on site, and I recognize with Malte, like he's amazing in tech, and I also have a tech background, but I'm always the person who's like writing some emails to some random people like, do you have some pre-server capacities for us? okay, so what I wonder is, at some point you were selling the thing. If you didn't raise a lot of money, did you like had a huge exit which gave you some free money for building like the next big thing? So was it like a really profitable exit, or how did it went for you when selling Lifestyle Asia?
I mean, it was a decent exit. I can't mention numbers because Birda is a family office and family owned, not operated that way. But they don't talk about exits unless they have to announce them. They never talk about profitability. They may talk about their top line revenue as a group, but they're quite secretive, right? But, you know, it was an okay deal. I mean, I'm still working, obviously. I'm not drinking pina colada on a beach. So that might be somewhat telling. But I think the reality is, I'm also a guy who probably can't sit still and drink pina coladas on the beach for very long because I get bored. And so I love the part where the building part, right? The going from zero to one. I think it's really fun. And I need to do things. I was never diagnosed with ADHD or anything of that nature. And to a large degree, I think that's a superpower. If you have it, you understand how to use it, or you have some other combination, you know, but I probably have a dang of it. And so therefore, for me to just, you know, I don't know. I also grew up with a dad who kind of told me that people sleeping daytime is bums, right? That's the people you see sitting on the corner, you know. And so we had that mentality growing up, me and my brothers. And so I can't sleep longer than 7 in the morning, right? I just feel irregardless of the day.
Crazy.
Right?
Okay.
And it might happen. Sleep on a Saturday until 8, and it happens. But I tend to go up 6:30 every morning, 7 days. And usually I have a PT, even though I don't look like a fit guy, who comes to my house at 7 or 7:15. So, well, I need to. I also have a young boy; he's 4 years old. So, you know, that sort of wakes me up. But yeah, I mean, it was a decent exit. Yeah.
And this also got you into investing or something else? Because I see you're a board member in many companies. You're an investment director at FMAB. So you're more now into venture capital?
I'm not. I'm not a VC. I have invested into certain things. I'm the largest investor in my current business, which, you know, was taken from my previous exit, right? So I do kind of, you know, invest in things that I believe in, obviously, but it tends to be more PE, private equity, that I somewhat can control the outcome of. I mean, you can never truly control it, but I do want to kind of have a hand in it. I'll probably go into full-time investing once I'm sort of done with my pet go. And when I say done, I don't know, maybe when I step down one day, or if we do a trade sales and it's an exit that way, or if it's a listing and I sell off X through that listing, and then I'll probably, you know, look at technology investing, but with not necessarily a board seat, but with an advisory role, and try to be as active as I can to help in any area I think I can contribute to, right? I don't want to micromanage or any of that. I have zero interest in that. But I don't think I need to build the companies forever. I could have junior entrepreneurs doing that, and I'm just partner of that, and I contribute as I can. And I think that could be a way to kind of, like a chain smoker who smoked 40 cigarettes, he goes down to 20, and then he goes down to 10 and 5 and, you know, 0. Like, for me to step away from it entirely is probably going to be hard. I do that, and my wife has to be no more big stuff after this, because, you know, we need to have you around more, which is, of course,
the interesting. So this is your last startup you're building.
Well,
probably.
I mean, as a CEO, possibly.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. So what's this?
Co-founder and other stuff,
So we all, your wife doesn't listen to the podcast. And
She will not. And she prefers that I stay very quiet about what we do and whatnot. And, you know, and I, she's maybe right.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. Okay. I wonder, did you do that immediately? Like, did you close the company before, or sold the company before, and then immediately started My Pet Go, or was there like a phase of orientation in between?
I mean,
I mean, I sort of, started a venture builder, which is, you know, where we sort of, we had a thesis where we said, we want to start ventures where we are, the entrepreneur, the investor, first check, right? We're the builder, we're the operator. And the thesis was we want to do that. We want to try to build something that's as self-sustainable as possible. That means that it doesn't have to raise and raise and raise and raise, right? Try to, you know, come to product market fit rather quickly and then, you know, try to make it profitable and kind of, you know, as we expand, we kind of do that in a more organic way. And out of that, MyPetGo came. But the thesis with that was, let's focus on ventures that can help to solve large problems and either for humans, either for the planet, or either for animals, right? And obviously MyPetGo is something that helps actually all three, if you think of it, but more so the first and the last, which is the human in that equation, which is the pet owner or caretaker, and then the pet being the dog or the cat, but we're never focused on dogs. We'll look at felines later on, maybe horses, maybe other things, but it's a dog-only proposition right now. And so I went from, you know, being a managing director at Birda and a board member and everything else that I was there, and then into this Rhino Ventures, which was the idea. And we wanted to build rhinos as opposed to unicorns, you know, something that is more, you know, that takes on that organic growth idea, and that is valued at, you know, a profit multiple as opposed to a revenue multiple, which tends to be the case for the unicorns that don't very often are profitable. And MyPetGo was the first venture. Now, the idea was to run five ventures concurrently using one central team, but MyPetGo became so complicated and so complex as a venture that we had to focus on that, stop with the venture building entirely, and the whole team moved over to MyPetGo, and it was just MyPetGo. And that we started close to 4 years ago. And so that's all we've been really focused in that area and sort of, you know, trying not to spread ourselves too thin. But MyPetGo is essentially like a whoop strap or an aura ring, but for a dog. So we look at health markers. We report these health markers to the owner through a smartphone application. And if a health marker is out of range, meaning it's abnormal, we then send you a push notification. We tell you that this marker is abnormal. And it could be an array of reasons for that. But if that marker is then sustained for a longer period of time, we then send you a second notification that you can triage to understand what is it that it has made this value go out of range. Then we give you CTA buttons that you can click on that would provide a solution to the identified problem. Right. So that is an ecosystem model where we first provide simplistic, understandable data. Then the second dimension is what can I do with this data as a caretaker? And you know, you don't have to be a data scientist to understand this or a vet. The third one is we connect you to a service provider or product that can help with that particular problem, right? And so it's a platform play, it's an ecosystem play, it's a complete data play. What I learned towards the end at Birda was we can't compete with the fangs, you know, the platform players, which was the Metas and the Googles and the TikToks, because they own the data, they have both the supply and the demand, and they produce no content, right? It's impossible to compete with them. So I said to myself, whatever I do next, I need to be able to harness data in a meaningful way, yet in a non-evil way, right? I don't want to steal the data and someone signed it away 10 years ago, not knowing what it was. So here we're sort of saying, look, we will leverage the data to the maximum, but it's your data. And we're doing that only to improve the product so that you can better nurture and understand your pet, and we can be, and you can become more reactive. We don't sell it to any third party. We do nothing like that. And we have no intention of doing that. So the idea really is, looking at health markers, behavior traits like mobility, so activity, inactivity, itching, licking, scratching, like all of these different things, and kind of giving you an idea of how they're feeling physically and emotionally, and making you reactive. And then with that, we built a longevity program, which is all about how can we improve the quality of life when that dog is still around, and also how can we extend lifespan possibly by having a program that tells you how to feed your dog, how to exercise your dog, how to, you know, groom and nurture your dog, how to look at preventative care, when to take your vaccine, when to take your deworming tablet, when to go for dental scaling, which is the same as us humans. We need to go to the dentist twice a year. Same with the dog, right? I mean, I just pulled out 16 teeth, not myself, but my dog, the 10-year-old Maltese. And the reality with that is I brush his teeth pretty much every day. And most pet owners don't do that. And I take him for dental scaling. But still, as they age, you know, he's like the equivalent of a 75-year-old human, right? And so a 75-year-old human tends to have some issues with the teeth too, right? And so now it was so bad, it was spraying down to the jaw, and it was like either we take them out or it could spread further down, and then that could lead to cancer and other things. And I was like, okay, let's take them out. But, you know, imagine waking up with 17 teeth pulled out. You're going to feel a bit bad for a while. So that was last week I did that. So with the reason I'm telling you that is that what we're adding now into the longevity program is the ability of using image recognition, where we use AI and machine learning models to shag through images in the database of, you know, whatever it pertains to. So, we have this stool sample. So stool, for those that don't understand what it is basically poop. So as a dog owner, you pick up poop maybe twice a day. You can take a picture of it, upload it into the application, and they will tell you with a high degree of certainty whether you have parasites in the stool, whether you have blood in the stool, whether you have any kidney issue or liver issue that's coming up, any poison, red poison, or anything else in the stool. So it's a pretty cool thing. So it's neural image recognition, and we're building the same thing for skin, for eyes, and for teeth. We'll be able to help you with eye infections. As they age, they get a lot of issues. With the teeth that I just went through, like imagine if I had that tech and I would have been able to find out things sooner, because the only way to do it now is you go to the vet, you have to then go and take an MRI of what the face looks like. And essentially a scan, right? And then kind of looking at it that way. It's A, expensive, it takes time, you need a specialist vet that has the equipment to do it, right? And so imagine you could do that with the smartphone and upload it, right? And use neural image recognition. So we're building that. We're also doing the same, as I said, with skin and eyes. So we think that between what we have with the sensor data, which is a wearable that goes around the neck, which is what we have now, to this neural image recognition that you will then do on a regular basis in the program that we built, the longevity program, to self-assessment, where we ask you questions, and then leveraging general Gen AI or regenerative artificial intelligence. So we're a data business. We're not a wearable business, and it's all about using the data and using AI to make sense of it and to give these next step recommendations, so that we are streamlining the work of being a pet parent, and making sure that we take out the guesswork in that equation and make sure that, you know, your pet will live a longer life, a happier life, and you'll bond with your pet in a different way. And you'll also get peace of mind, you'll save money, you'll save time, all these other things, right? But they're almost secondary, right? Like they're a byproduct. The real thing, the mission and vision is, you know, improving life of your pet and extending life of your pet. And then that should make you happier, because this is a family member, right?
I saw on Crunchbase that you raised 550K. You told me in advance that you actually raised 3.7 million now. And I wonder, like, is this connected with the idea of, okay, in the long run, it could be also possible that this longevity program is also available for humans? Is this the long-term goal?
Yeah. Yeah. So look, let's start with the raise. So we've raised a total of $6+ million for MyPetGo. Mm-hmm. Crunchbase is not the most reliable, nor is PitchBook or any of the others. We're also a Singaporean HQ'd company, and that's our parent company. Then we have a company in the US, we have a company in the UK, and now we have one in Spain. So I have no idea where they're crawling and pulling numbers from, but the last round we did, we haven't announced. It will be announced next month, but that's on the race. In terms of, can we clone some of the tech and leverage that for humans? Yeah, I mean, look, I think you could, but I think, so here's the thing, whatever we see in the pet space, it's about 10 years behind the human healthcare space. Okay, so there are a lot of cool stuff happening in the human space, and there's been some cool things already. I think you look at people like Brian Johnson with the Blueprint, what he's doing there. You have other people in that network, from Peter Attia to you know, some of the other guys that are kind of up there looking at longevity that have these kind of apps for that. So I think, you know, for us to try to be good at the human healthcare space when we're trying to push the pet one is a fight that's going to be very hard for us. So in theory, yes. Are we going to do it? Probably not, right? We're going to be very focused on dogs until we nail dogs, then we'll move on to felines, which is cats, and then maybe horses, because there's a big demand for that sector, and there's a lot of money in it. But I think, yeah, so that's what we're doing. Everything we're pushing right now is longevity, and we think that that's going to be driven by artificial intelligence. We think the next decade, it's going to be all about longevity. And I'm coming from the pet sector, right? So we think that the pet care industry is going to be driven by longevity. We're starting to see some things happening, but very little if we compare it to the human side. And again, you know, we're at least 10 years behind. Maybe if you look at Asia, you're probably 15 or 20 years behind. So it's like, you know, it's really happening more in the US market and in the European markets. That was one of the reasons why I moved from Singapore and kind of live in Barcelona. I needed to be closer to, you know, the main markets for the pet care industry, which tends to be the larger European markets, and obviously U.S., Canada. So a lot of stuff happening over in LATAM. Brazil is a huge market for dogs. I mean, it's the second largest globally, 135 million dogs there, companion dogs. So it's a massive market, right? And China is becoming an enormous market, and obviously US is a big market. But then, you know, Germany is a big market, France is a big market, Spain is a big market, Italy is a big market. Depends on what you're doing, right? If you're selling pet food, every market is a good market, right? In theory, but you know, people don't swap their pet food brands a lot, so you gotta get in early, right, on a pup level.
And you sent me some numbers that you think it will be like a $35 billion market by 2035.
Yeah. I mean, that's pet technology, right? Which, you know, if you look at the pet care industry, that's going to be by 2030, it's going to be around $500 billion. Dollars,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's crazy. That are insane numbers. I didn't know that people spend these amounts on their pets. I mean, it makes sense to me when thinking about it, but it's insane. Like that's crazy.
It's driven, you know, the largest group of pet owners today, and the fastest growing is Gen Z and millennials, obviously, more so the former than the latter, And this group, they may not want to have human kids, right? So their de facto child is a fur baby, right? It's a dog or a cat. And you know, these people may also be renters. They don't want to own property. And so they have a big disposable income that then goes to spoiling their pet. And, you know, some of these people spend, $1,000 a month on food and grooming and care. And if you want to buy a golden retriever, I think in Singapore, it's maybe a 2-year wait list and that is a 20K dog today, right? If you want it, purely bred. So A, it's expensive. B, to get maybe your dream dog. I always tell everybody who's interested is, I say adopt, because there is incredible, beautiful dogs out there that deserve a new chance. And all they want is some love and attention and a warm home with some food and shelter. And so I think a lot of people, should look at that option instead of getting pure.
Yeah. My family has a dog from the dog shelter, and we love him so much. Do you have a dog yourself? I guess and think so.
Of course I do. That's the poor chap that I had to pull out 16 of his teeth last week.
So
his name is Caesar. He's a Maltese, which is a toy breed, so he's 3 kilos of pure lab. I've had him from pretty much since he was 2 months, so he used to fit in my hand. Now he's a little bit bigger. He's very attached to me. I'm the main caretaker, and he's an anxious and nervous dog, and he was part of the inspiration. I kind of like the pet care industry and the pet industry, and I saw that it was very similar to publishing in that it was very analog and it needed to be digitalized. And again, I was speaking to yuppies and early adopters back then, or millennials as you call them today. So I'm kind of doing a rinse and repeat. It's like taking something that's static and digitalizing it, and then the same type of target audience. And so it's quite similar. Yes, it's a different sector.
I was once listening to a podcast which got me really confused, like one of the biggest business podcasts in Germany, where a guy was in the pet industry and then said no, I don't have a dog or a cat, or I'm not even into animals. I just see this as a really interesting market. So this feels more natural now that you have a dog yourself, but you like animals. a thing you identify with.
I mean, look, I see that all the time with peers in the industry. Like, you got two sides. You got the ones that have never had a pet and probably never will have a pet, but they're in the industry and they tend to be opportunistic, right? And then you have the people that are in it for all the wrong reasons. They're doing something that's quite silly and they just love their pets. They got 5 dogs and 7 cats and, 3 hippos and they got everything, right? And so you have both, right? And then you maybe have the people in the middle. Maybe I'm one of those that has a dog and I can relate to it and I understand it. And where I got my human child, I was very much similar to these other guys. My dog went everywhere. I mean, my dog has been in 35 countries. He's been flying intercontinental a few times and he has a passport and so, which is something you get when you're in Europe anyways. It's a dog passport, but you need to bring that as you travel cross border. But if you never had a dog or a cat, I mean, cats are beautiful pets too. I'm a little bit in favor of a dog because they tend to be a bit more engaging, right? I like cats too, obviously.
Yeah, I also consider myself a dog person, but I also like cats too. How do you, so you mentioned you have a dog passport now, and I think Europe is really bureaucratic in general. And I recognize that lots of founders are moving out of Europe or out of Germany, but also some are migrating to US or to Asia. And also some even don't really tell officially in the podcast, but I know that they have a German company, but they don't live in Germany. How is your feeling about, because I mean, you've seen so many different countries, about Spain, like building a company within Spain compared to, for example, Singapore?
Well, okay. I mean, so we can start with the basics. I can set up a company in Singapore on the day, right? Online.
And it's without effects.
In Spain, it takes you, 2 to 3 months. And it's bureaucratic. You got to go to the notary. I mean, we hardly have notaries back in Asia, right? And it's a lot of stamping and paper pushing and signatures. I mean, you don't need any of that in Singapore or in Hong Kong, or you know, it's super straightforward, right? And that's why they steal away a lot of businesses. I mean, you have no capital gain. You have no dividend tax. You have tax breaks the first couple of years. You can push, your losses, you can push forward and offset against future profits. There's a lot of beautiful stuff, right? But I think, you know, Spain is maybe a country where you set up a back office and you have maybe a tech hub here because there is talent here. There's lots of American nomads. They have tech nomad visa. But I think a lot of the companies that are in Spain, they don't necessarily have a big business in Spain, but they got an employment company here. And then the business is outside of Spain, right? I'm not saying that's true for all, because certainly you have very big companies here too, like Glovo, which is, you know, the Just Eat or the food panda of Spain, right? To a lot of other big native ones, right? But I think Europe, unfortunately, is bureaucratic, and you know, our milk prices are controlled by a couple of people sitting in Brussels, right? It's called the European Union, to our gas prices, to everything else, and it is sad to see what the continent is, you know, what's happening, and that's why we have a far right movement in every country, right? You got the AfD in Germany, and we got the Swedish Democrats in Sweden. We got the UK. We got Le Pen, who obviously, conquers over in or will certainly conquer in the upcoming election. In France, and Geert Wilders, who won in the Netherlands, and you know, and the list goes on. And I think people have had enough, and that bureaucratic side needs to go away. But so Spain is, you know, once you're through the process, it's okay, right? You got the Beckham Law in Spain, which is interesting. So if you're a successful entrepreneur that has a business, you can come here and set up a subsidiary. You can apply for the Beckham Law, which is the same kind of thing as the tech nomad visa. But if you make income in a different country, you're not taxed on that. You're only taxed on what you bring home in Spain, 24% flat. And so, and that came when David Beckham obviously went to play for Real Madrid in that place. So it is very entrepreneurial friendly in that.
So it's a tax haven, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you can organize having somewhere else for income.
Yeah. I mean, for someone like you that like the mountains, you should check out Andorra, which is where I live, about a 2-hour and 15-minute drive. I mean, that's a tax haven. That's the Monaco of this part of the world. And you know, you can set up a company and you pay, you know, depending on which scheme you go for, but you can set up a company where you pay next to no tax on the business, and then your income tax is, I think, at 2% or something. It's 2% corporate tax and 10% income tax, and that's the number one in Europe, I think, at the time. And it's super safe, super clean air, great skiing winter time. Beautiful hiking and these kind of things, summertime or mountain biking or whatever you want to do. Full of entrepreneurs too. A lot of crypto and Bitcoin guys tend to like it there. You know, they made it a haven. So you see very young people driving around in hypercars and whatnot.
Again, not sure if I fit in there, but...
Now you got all types there, all types. But... Oh. And that's another area. And there you can do things rather quickly. So it kind of depends on what you want to do. I think Spain is what it offers is a very beautiful balance between work life and not work life, right? And I think, you know, tons of sunshine, beautiful beaches, a very diverse country that offers a lot of a lot of differentiated parts to it. Fantastic food, wine, and you know, all of this, right? And all of that comes at a bang for the buck, right? Whereas you pay 30, 40, 50% more in Germany or anywhere in Northern Europe, right?
Yeah, I think you also see, which is interesting to me, like you see the stream of Europeans going to Asia and to the US, but you also see like especially people from US coming to Europe.
Yes.
And I think there are good reasons for that. I mean, we have a good healthcare system. We have I think in the end, it's really nice, but we have like a social government in most European countries. And I think taxes are spent really well in most countries. And I think also like, I'm not sure if I would feel good with paying no taxes. I think I feel like right now paying too much taxes, but no yes. taxes at all. But where I probably would also feel like, oh no, I think there are some pretty good things done with that money. And I think in general, like Europe has so much culture and so many cool people from different places with different languages. And
yeah,
I really get also why people move to Europe as well. I just hope that one day we don't have bureaucracy anymore. Okay. In 10 years, where do you want to be with My Pet Go?
So look, I think I think in 10 years, I would probably not run the company anymore. It will be someone younger with more vigor than me and more stamina than me. I will not be sitting on the beach drinking pina colada. I'll probably be helping other younger entrepreneurs with, you know, all sorts of advisory and investment and other things. I think that's going to be my sort of calling in the future. I like that. I might go back to building a venture builder and look at that model, because we call it a future builder because we're building these futuristic companies and our model was somewhat different from the traditional one. We were not an incubator. We were not a normal venture builder. That's what we called the future builder. So maybe I'll do that. But I think, you know, my Pet Go will be in a very good place. It will probably be listed by that time, you know, on New York Stock Exchange, or it will be. And it will probably have been acquired in a trade sales, if not listed, right? And so certainly that goal is there. I think we're going to acquire, invest, and build around the IP that we have. And that's the current strategy. We are looking at buying up IP that is synergistic, that can fit next to what we're doing. And we have engaged in one such deal that's going to be announced soon as well. And, you know, as I said, we raised more money. That's also going to be announced. And we're looking at something bigger where we're building an investment vehicle or a strategic operator around what we're doing. And we're going to go very, very deep into the world of pet longevity and artificial intelligence, which I think will be the driver. So I think sky is the limit, right? So it's a listing or trade sales that's going to happen in the next 5 years. Either or, it could be later on. It depends on the, if somebody wants to buy it, obviously, and if the listing condition makes sense at that time. You know, I think what we've learned is companies can stay private longer. But I think our ambition is, in the world of artificial intelligence, you can't build everything yourself. You're going to have to acquire other companies. I think we'll do that with shares. And I think we want smart people to kind of come in and help us push this together. And, you know, one of the mistakes I made in the past was I had an opportunity to merge with another luxury and lifestyle publishing company. And if we would have done that, we would have done a better exit collectively than separately. They also managed to sell their business to a big publishing group. But I think we should have come together early, because we had an opportunity to do it early. We sat down and we discussed it. But I think the chemistry wasn't there. We did a far better exit than they did, probably X more than they did. but we also stayed in it longer. We didn't give up. That it's, you know, it's about a time having stamina and the right timing. But something is hot for a minute, and then when it's not hot anymore, nobody may want it. And if you can't make money on it, you're not, you know, that opportunity is gone. So once the window opens, you got to decide, do I climb through this window or do I let it close? And if it never opens again, am I okay with that? So you got to ask yourself that. But I think learning from my previous mistakes, I've surrounded myself with a lot of good advisors and investors, and I'm using their, because I'm a solo entrepreneur in this. I do sort of have a co-founder in it, but I'm sort of a main driver in it. But whereas before I had two co-founders and always had to kind of, you know. So I think here that's really what we want to do. You know, we want to have a very high ambition, and the ambition has changed. You know, I would have been happy to have sold this business for 100 million. You know, if you asked me a year ago, in the future, not saying it was worth 100 million last year. But I think today, I think this could be a billion plus. It's a data play, do it right. And I think that's difficult if you don't acquire other companies, if you don't acquire revenue, if you don't acquire users, if you don't acquire databases. And so that's what we're going to do. And we've started that already. And I think we're going to speed it up, because I think the next 1, 2, and 3 years are going to be crucial. You know, who's going to be the winner? I don't know. We'll see. But we would like to be the winner.
Crazy. I would be excited to listen again to this exact podcast in 10 years.
Yes.
And, we'll see where my Petco is then. But I actually think like it's a really interesting field, because the technology is quite new, like the image recognition, like with the AI image. I miss the word, but like with AI, that you really precisely can recognize something on image is just like a simple technology, which is now easy accessible for everyone, but hard to implement and hard to train. And I think that's a really interesting business model, and longevity of animals is something I never thought about. So thank you so much for being today in the podcast, I'd say.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it a lot. Good talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to hear more like that, please don't forget to subscribe, and see you next time. Bye.